Time to take a look at the world of wildlife here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today. Jamie Nack, Scott Craven back with us. Jamie's a UW Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist. Jamie, good to see you. And Scott Craven, you probably know who he is. He comes by once in a while for about the last 30 years.
I tried to come by a couple times in December, but no one wanted to hear me.
Well, there were other things going on in the political arena that kept us off the air for that time. But anyway, Scott, of course, an emeritus professor in the Department of Wildlife Ecology, Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. They're both with that department as well as Extension. So we'll talk about how the Australian wildfires affected wildlife. So we'll do a little international work today. And then we'll look at the deer hunting season for this year here in Wisconsin, talk about birds, and hope you'll join in the conversation with your own questions and comments and experiences to share. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's talk about those that terrible toll that fires are taking, especially on wildlife. You watch the news, and I've seen some just terrible photos.
It's heartbreaking.
Heartbreaking, isn't it, Jamie?
Yeah, heart-wrenching.
Scott, dude.
The fires in Australia are enough of a disaster, the wildlife notwithstanding. But the wildlife loss strikes pretty close for me. Seeing those images is heartbreaking.
Oh.
I know it bothers me. I know it bothers my wife a lot. And we've been to many of those places. We've been to the Australia Zoo, which is one of the places coordinating relief efforts. And I think that we're a long way from there. However, there are a couple of things to think about. Number one, Australia's fauna is unlike any other on the planet. Their mammal populations are completely dominated by marsupials. Placentals are unusual. It's just the opposite here. Our only marsupial is the possum. So it's a unique wildlife community on the entire planet, and it's clear that it's being decimated by these fires. The estimates that some of the Australians have put forward, upwards of 500 million or half a billion animals, including mammals, birds, reptiles, and so forth, I think that falls into the category really of an educated guess. That's really all it can be.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really matter. The point is, it's whatever it is, it's a huge number. And as people see these images and think about what's going on there, there are some things, even though it's a long ways from here, there are some things that people here in Wisconsin can do. And I think your producer has put an impressive list of websites and organizations together, which people can access through your program page.
Yeah, let me just give that WPR.org/Larry. If you go there, you're going to be able to get a list of different places that are legitimate places where you can, if you want to contribute in one way or another, you can do it.
So just as an assortment, there is an effort being coordinated by the Australia Zoo Wildlife Hospital. Remember, this is the family of Steve Irwin's, the crocodile hunter, which most of the people in this country know about. They're taking care of displaced, particularly flying foxes, large fruit bats, and koalas. And I think it's the koalas that most people relate to. Seeing somebody stop on a bike and give a koala that looks singed a drink out of their water bottle is pretty
pretty
hard to watch. But anyway, they're involved. There are other organizations like Wildlife Victoria, Zoos Victoria, the Kangaroo Island Wildlife Park that many people who have toured Australia have visited. Go to that site you mentioned, and if you're inclined to do something by way of donation or there's any other support you can provide, please do so. It's a disaster for wildlife on a global front. The other issue that I wanted to bring up about it is that I think there are certainly many scientists and Australians who would agree that this particular event has been made much worse by current conditions in Australia in terms of drought and heat and wind and so forth. And there are certainly plenty of people in the scientific community and the meteorological community who are willing to pin some of the responsibility for that on climate change, which is in turn pinned on our own activity globally. Yesterday at noon, I attended a talk by one of our well-known local meteorologists on the Madison TV scene, and he presented he's part of a citizens group dealing with climate change issues and climate change awareness. And I'd seen most of the data before, but not presented in that organized fashion. But the evidence is compelling that, folks, something's going on here, and it's been going on since the Earth started the Industrial Revolution and started burning fossil fuels, and it's getting worse and worse, faster and faster. And we seem to be preoccupied with other kinds of events, political and so forth, when it's hard to think that this particular issue isn't really, in terms of the well-being of humanity and our global environment, this is really the pressing issue. So that's related to the Australian situation. And if the Australian fires have done one thing, it's taken off the public plate the disastrous Amazonian fires, which were only a couple months ago, but now have been supplanted by this problem in Australia. And there's too much of that stuff going on. And then you look at our own weather and the fact that we're still – Wisconsin is basically a mud hole right now as far as agriculture is concerned. And we've got this bizarre weather between the northern and southern parts of the state. And something doesn't quite add up.
No, it doesn't indeed. We have so I want to go back and just mention again, relating to Australia, we have a list of legitimate organizations that are working to help animals. And I think there's some things in general as well in Australia. There's a link to that list on our site. I hope you just go to the Larry Mueller Show. And you will find that list, and if you feel like you want to do something, go ahead and do it.
Yeah, I should point out, Larry, I agree with you. I don't mean by emphasizing the wildlife problem. This is just something that we tend to talk about on these programs and that I'm certainly involved with from a professional standpoint. But seeing the images of people's homes going up in flames or the forests just disappearing, annihilated, that's certainly more problematic for a variety of reasons. But it's all part of the same fire impact.
Well, we can talk about that some more, or we can take other questions. We already have some other questions relating to our own wildlife here in Wisconsin. Certainly, if you have a question or a comment, or maybe you've got a wildlife experience to share, I hope you'll join in. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest Scott Craven and Jamie Nack from UW Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Taking a look at the world of wildlife here on the Ideas Network, Larry Mueller here with Scott Craven and Jamie Nack from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison and UW Extension. Jill Nadeau, our producer today, by the way, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. It's always great to have them as well. And we'll take some calls now. Again, you can join in 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call. Chris in Madison has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Chris.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I feel terrible in a way changing the subject from what's happening in Australia, which is so tragic. I have a small problem compared to that.
Well, that's all right.
But I was thrilled to hear that Scott Craven was going to be on, so I wanted to ask this. I have a flying squirrel problem. Over the last about 5 years, we have gotten maybe 4 to 5 flying squirrels in our attic. We do not know how they're getting in. They're small. They're finding some location. But we have live trapped them and taken them at least 10 miles from our home, And we have one that I just wonder if it might have come back again. Is it possible for them to come back from a location or distance that far away? And other than finding the source of entry, which we will still continue to try to do, does Scott have any recommendations?
Well, I don't think that although it's possible, and animals are known to return from relocations for surprising distances. And, you know, you hear stories on the news of, oh, we lost our family pet while we were on vacation in Yellowstone, and now it's home in New Jersey and doing just fine. So anything's possible, but I think 10 miles is a safe distance for a flying squirrel. That's a lot of climbing up a tree and gliding 20 feet to the next tree. So I think you're doing the right thing there if that's the approach you choose. But you're also correct that the only long-term solution to this is to figure out how they're getting into the house and make sure they can't.
Daylight's the best time to look, isn't it? Go
there,
up
there
in the
are,
attic.
There and... are a couple of approaches. Go up in the attic or send somebody up there on a bright, sunny day and look for little pinpoints of light that might suggest that there's a hole or a crack here and there. Conversely, you can send somebody up there with a cue beam or a powerful spotlight to shine around and go out on a dark night and see where you see the little bit of light coming out from the outside. So either way, that may point you to things like, where a utility cable enters the attic and the ring guard that are usually put on those has fallen off, or there's a missing soffit board or a crack or a hole or the flashing around the chimney or who knows what. But you have to really be diligent to find all those openings. In the meantime, I think you're right to not try and share your attic with them. They're cute little buggers, but they are squirrels, and therefore they're rodents, and therefore they have the potentially damaging incisor teeth of all rodents. So they will gnaw on your insulation, on insulated wiring, and root around in the insulation and do other things that squirrels do. So it is a good idea to try and exclude them, move them when you can. And beyond that, I think you're on the right path.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Before we go back to the phones, Jamie Nack, we've had some unusual weather, as Scott was saying, mm-hmm. so far this winter. Do you think it's had any effect on our wildlife yet?
Well, I think certainly if we talk about bird feeders and activity at the feeders, I would guess most callers are seeing a little slower response and maybe less species diversity at the feeders. But as Scott alluded to earlier, our winter is really quite different in the north, what the northern Wisconsin folks are seeing versus southern Wisconsin. So really warm down here, not a lot of snow cover. Our feeders have certainly been slow, I would say, with the exception of woodpeckers. Been going through suet quite a bit. And blue jays and cardinals have certainly been present, but not going through the large quantities of seed. Northern Wisconsin really still covered in a lot of snow.
Yeah.
So I don't think we've necessarily had all of the winter visitors haven't necessarily pushed as far south as in some of our areas at our local feeders. And just the milder weather, I think even if we talk about bald eagles, we're going to talk about them and upcoming watching days. But their concentrations with not having the colder weather, we haven't had as much ice cover. We've got a lot of open water, so we're not seeing the concentrations at this point. I think that'll pick up here in the next month or so. It's been a very unusually warm weather, winter.
Mike in Boscobel has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Mike.
Hi. My question is, I've listened to your show for many, many years, and I would like to see more grouse and less turkeys. It seems like in southwestern Wisconsin, when the turkeys established is when our grouse population went down, and talking to some people in the northern section of the state, they're experiencing that now. As their turkey population increases, their grouse population drops. Is there anything we can do to we still have the popple thickets down here, and there has been some change in habitat, but not a lot. Is there anything that the state can do about reestablishing grouse in the south part of the state and seeing what's happening to the northern population?
Well, Mike, I'll take a start at that and have Scott add in as he chooses, but this is certainly a question that Scott and I hear a lot when it comes to landowners very interested in habitat management for rough grouse. What can we do to bring back their populations, especially in the Southwest? But we have landowners ask us that question from all over the state, and even in the Southeast, where we really don't have a good stronghold of grouse remaining. I see the logic in realizing that our turkey populations have expanded. They've done far better than we ever imagined when they started to be reintroduced. I don't think anybody ever thought they would establish in northern Wisconsin. But we have them in, I would suspect, every county of the state. And their populations have done really well. At the same time, we've seen declines in rough grouse numbers. And specifically in that southwest area, when you talk to folks in that area, as Mike is, talking about their ventures in the woods 30 years ago and all the flushes that they would see. But when we start to look at it, I think it really is a habitat difference or habitat changes. And some of that is a difference in a more maturing woodlot or forest canopy. So we're getting more mature forests and less of that aspen, early successional forest that the grouse depend on. And so that is changing, or it may be there, but it's a more fragmented landscape that allows for more predation as these grouse are moving across the landscape in the Southwest. So I think habitat's a key feature. I think when you look at competition between grouse and turkeys, they have different survival, different strategies, life strategies to begin with. They don't necessarily feed on the same things. They don't nest in the same locations. That they're not seen as habitat competitive in terms of the habitats and their food and nesting and so on. And so we can look at grouse tend to be more of a butter, budding and sitting in trees. Turkeys aren't that light, so it's hard for them to do that. And again, they nest in different locations. So I think it still is really a matter of a difference in habitat and loss of some of that early successional forest habitat that we need that the rough grouse need. So in terms of restoring that, there's certainly been efforts by the Rough Grouse Society and other partners to work in the Southwest in more of a cooperative nature with landowners. And certainly in the northern part of the state with the cutting and timber management that's going on some of the federal and state properties as well. So I'll kick it over to Scott if he has anything else he wants to chime in with.
Add in there, Scott?
No, Jamie's right. Turkey populations and grouse populations will fluctuate as they're forced to do by their own habitat choice, life history strategies, and so forth. And there's not a particularly great amount of interaction. So we're not seeing less turkeys because of more grouse or vice versa. Unlike Mike, I would like to see, my goal would be lots of turkeys and lots of grouse. And,
right.
But I think, as Jamie pointed out, the recovery of grouse in southwestern Wisconsin, which was once a pretty good stronghold for them, is not a short-term issue and not a very easy one to solve with the higher human footprint on the landscape and more intensive everything. Whether that'll ever happen or not, I don't know, but that's just the way the environment has changed, and we'll have to move forward and make the best of it.
And Mike, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. I want to give Sonia and Mekwan a chance to join in. Hi, Sonia.
Hi, how are you?
Well, I've got a little cold, but otherwise I'm fine.
Better than he was.
Yeah, better than I was even yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Good. I just had a quick question for you. I had a couple episodes with a squirrel kind of infiltrating my home, and I called an exterminator, and they were able to catch the squirrel both times. But in that process, I did a little bit of research, and I found out, according to the research, that squirrels have a complete disdain for anything peppered, like cayenne pepper or pepper. And they even suggested that you take that substance, the cayenne pepper or just regular pepper, add water to it and put it in a spray bottle and just spray on the area that the squirrels have contact with. Is that accurate?
Scott, go ahead.
Yes, sort of. I don't think that regular household black pepper would make much difference, but red pepper and the active ingredient in chili peppers and hot sauce, which is called capsaicin, is used as a squirrel repellent, and it's available commercially in a powdered form at bird feeding stores as a seed additive. Birds don't care about it, so you mix it in your seed. The squirrels don't like it, so it helps a little bit there. There are some commercial trade names for the products. Or you can get the ingredient and probably try the spray bottle approach that Sonia mentioned. So it does have some merit. Generally speaking, repellents like that, especially if you're spraying something outdoors, they often don't weather very well. So you spray it and all of a sudden it rains or snows and you need to reapply it and forget about it and then the problem's back. So, excuse me. It has some application issues, but if you're diligent about it, it's worth a try. It does have some merit.
The best thing is find where they're getting in. And
yeah, exclusion is still your long-term best, whether it be hardware cloth or aluminum, something that's going to keep them from gnawing and gaining access. But in the short term, it can help alleviate some damage.
There you go, Sonia. Thank you. Alex in Appleton. Hi.
Hi. I just have two comments. The first one, when the woman called in about the flying squirrels, and I believe it was Scott who was saying they can damage your insulation and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
I've had personal experience with flying squirrels getting into my attic, and they can actually chew through PVC plumbing piping. Yeah, it was actually really scary. I was having a problem with my bathtub, and when the plumber went up there and took the drywall that was there between that part and the attic part, and you could see where its teeth had literally gnawed away and all the little shavings that were there. So people really need to take it seriously when rodents get into their home. It's not just messing up your insulation and creating an unhealthy environment. They can actually do some really big damage. So find
there
out where
you go.
They're getting in, stop them from getting in, do live traps, relocate them out into the country, do something, because they can do some pretty bad things. The second thing, I didn't catch where Jamie was saying that the birds weren't coming to her feeders much, because where I'm living, I'm having to fill my feeders literally every other day, and I'm getting black caps, nut hatches, cardinals, purple finches, mourning doves. I mean, you name it. I'm like, I have birds at my feeders all the time, and it hasn't stopped, even when it got cold. So, I don't know. In my area, I just keep telling everybody, keep your feeders full, because they're coming.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're going to talk a little bit about winter bird feeding and some tips as well. And I think the comment I had is just with this warmer weather and lack of snow cover, I think many birds that would visit feeders are also finding enough seed sources in the natural environment, because it is still readily available without that snow cover. So I've just noted, I certainly have activity. It just hasn't been as intense as it would typically be at this time of the year. And I think, again, the lack of snow cover, the availability of natural foods has slowed some of that activity at the feeders. So, and I expect it'll pick up here.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Alex. Appreciate it. Andy in Arcadia, it's your turn. Hi, Andy.
Hello. We have 1,500 acres of woods in the Driftless area.
Yep.
And we're part of the Conservation Stewardship Program. So we have a bird program in our woods. And we burn anywhere from 40 to 120 acres a year. And each parcel probably gets burned every 4 or 5 years.
Okay.
What? And we get a complete burn on the southwest side. And, of course, 1%, maybe 15% burn on the northeast side because it's so moist. But what we're trying to promote is hardwood trees regrowth and getting rid of invasive species. But what is that doing to the wildlife? Our deer hunters love it. But what is it doing to the overall wildlife habitat?
Scott, you want to?
Well, there may be some immediate problems for the odd rabbit or whatever that happens to be caught in the fire. But over the longer haul, the habitat benefits that you're creating, which are the things you talked about, hardwood regeneration, getting rid of some duff on the forest floor, stimulating overall plant growth, that's a very positive thing. And I think everybody understands the relationship in terms of burning prairie habitats. It's essential to keeping the prairie habitats healthy and going, and it's then of great benefit to the species involved in that habitat. So whether it's hardwood forests being burned or prairies or any other type of managed activity, fire is a useful management tool, and done correctly on limited areas like you're talking about, overall it's way over in the benefit side. There may be some short-term losses, like I said, if a ground nesting thrush, the nest happens to get burned over depending on the timing or whatever, but that in terms of put up against the overall benefit, it's grossly on the positive side.
Yeah, and to just distinguish this from like the fires, that the large scale fires going on in Australia, but that prescribed fire management plan that you referred to, Andy, with the acreage that you have and burning 40, 160 acres at a time, you know, on a rotational basis every 4 or 5 years, it's always leaving some areas of that property unburned so the wildlife have areas to nest, the birds can nest in a different unburned area and so on. But sounds like a really well-written plan.
Sounds like you know what you're doing, yep. Andy. Good luck. And actually, thanks for doing that.
Yep.
Now, if you look at it from a different perspective, if you're a grouse hunter, that's probably not doing a lot of good for the grouse.
Well, grouse aren't typically going to be a oak savanna, prairie-type species to begin with. But as with wildlife, when we work with private landowners, the beauty and hard part of owning land is you have to make some decisions. No matter what you do or decide for management, you're going to impact some species positively, and it's going to deter others. So you just kind of have to think about your overall goals. And certainly oak savanna and hardwood management and prairie species, grassland birds, it's much needed and pretty historic to what that area was at one time. So
he's doing good work. Yeah, thanks, Andy. Sure. Thank you so much. John in Toma, we'll go to you now. Hi, John.
Hey, how's it going there?
Good. Appreciate the call.
I had a question about, I'm a old-time deer hunter. I'm 58. Started when I was in 16 years old, dad taking me out and stuff. And I remember we hunt central Wisconsin, Wisconsin Rapids, Meadow Valley area like that, along the 173 area there. And I used to see a lot of deer back in the day. It's all public land, And then through the years, I haven't seen a lot of deer on public land anymore. It's like I used to see 20, 30 deer a day compared to like 10 years down the road. After that, you wouldn't hardly see, you'd be lucky if you see one deer a day. I was just wondering about that, and then.
Sure.
What if it's a management thing? Or if it's
something else,
decline in the population or whatever. But I'll take my answer off there.
John, thanks. Scott, you had wanted to talk about the deer season anyway.
Yes, I did. But as you know, Larry, discussions about the deer season have been going on since Leopold's day, and whether does should be harvested or not, and it hasn't changed. And if anything, it's gotten worse. And, here we are dealing with the aftermath of the Deer Trustee Report in 2012 and all the changes that were made. And now bizarre weather enters in and the latest possible deer season based on the calendar and a whole bunch of other factors. And, I had the same experience he did. I've been hunting almost that long. And I sat opening day in a county that's known for high deer densities where I used to see, it wasn't uncommon to see 50 or 60 or 70 deer in a day. Yeah, and I didn't see an animal. What, you had 12 guys up in northern Wisconsin at your deer camp, hunted for a week, saw exactly zero deer in a week, 12 people. So the problem here is for people who are not deer hunters, that there is no clear relationship between the number of deer in the woods and the number of deer actually seen. Based on the sign that was out there where I was, the trails beaten into the mud and deer rubs and scrapes everywhere and whatnot, the only conclusion could have been, well, there's a ton of deer here. But where were they? Well, weather considerations played into that this year. The late corn harvest was disastrous in some areas. But I think the real change has been in the way deer hunters actually hunt. And this has been written up by lots of the outdoor writers and whatnot. And, you know, the tendency now is to get yourself a nice big elevated stand with a Mr. Buddy heater in it and a cooler full of beverages and sit there on your butt for the daylight hours, if you can stand it that long. And maybe a deer walks by, maybe they don't. Deer drives have become all but non-existent. And for hunters, they'll know what that means. And in the areas that are affected by CWD dramatically, like the farm where I hunt, I would say that a good half of the properties around us no longer hunt at all. And so there's nobody out there. Yeah. So no one's moving around. The deer have no reason to go anywhere during the daylight hours. Mm-hmm. And as a result, you don't see them. So I think that those factors, and there are more, those factors play more into this individual's not seeing many deer than the actual numbers. Because if you think back to the pre-hunt reports, despite the fact that we haven't really seen projection the numbers since the Deer Trustee report, but all of a sudden this number came out, yes, folks, there's 2 million deer out there. You know, and I remember back in the glory years of high deer harvests, the population estimates were more in the neighborhood of 1.5 million to 1.8 million. So, well, wait a minute now. There's maybe more deer than we've ever had, but all these people reporting, I didn't see any deer. And the harvest continues to ratchet down, as it has for the past few years. So there's a very complicated relationship amongst all these things. And
there are some people who feel that deer report did more harm than actually created the opposite sort of situation for deer hunters in the state.
Yes, and I was going to point out that if you want to read a couple thoughtful pieces about this whole thing, in the last issue, the most recent issue of Outdoor News, the newspaper format Outdoor Bulletin, there was a very thoughtful editorial opinion type piece by both one of our DNR board members and by a former board member who's also a veterinarian and feels very strongly about CWD and its impacts. And one talked about the impacts of the Deer Trustee report and all the changes that were implemented, no more registration on site, no more tags, no this, no that. Forget about the units you hunted in for years. Now you're going to hunt in a county. Private land, public land, I don't know where I am. What's going on? All the different tags. And he was arguing for a return to a more simple deer season. And perhaps the restoration of some of the things that people actually seem to enjoy. I don't know how that'll play out over the next few years, but it is a very complicated interaction. And it's all also tempered by the fact that no matter how many deer there are, they're not equally distributed on the landscape. So every farm does not get 32% of the deer herd in that square mile or whatever. It just doesn't work that way. And I'm going to use a quote from one of my friends, a well-known outdoor writer, also in the Outdoor News. And his comment at the end of going through all of the statistics over the harvest and who's killing what and so on and so forth said, the deer are out there, folks. If that's not true where you hunt in Wisconsin, consider this. Abandon your dead zone and hunt them where they live. And, you know, there's some truth to that. Yeah. I've talked to my son about it. I said, hey, because of CWD and the way things have changed, that farm that I've been on now for – in 2022, it'll be 50 years I've been on the same wow. deer stand every opening day, save one when I was in the hospital. But anyway, you know, it's gotten to the point where I'm thinking about giving up that strong tradition and saying we got to go find a new place to hunt, which I consider a very bad thing. But that's the way it is. But anyway, there's a lot for people to think about. try and get past some of the arguments that are a waste of time, like crossbows. Should we have them? Shouldn't we? Stop arguing about that absolute foolishness, and deer need to be harvested. If there really were 2.1 million or whatever out there, and we only killed the number that are in the harvest, then there's going to be a lot more of them next year, and they ought to be harvested by whatever means people are willing to do it. But we'll see how that all plays out, too. But people need to be thinking about these things. We need to get some meaningful dialogue going, and I think some changes need to be made, or I'm afraid we're going to continue to see the deer hunter numbers declining, and that's not a good thing if this harvest is as necessary as it is to help with CWD and make sure those 500 and some hundred thousand deer hunters have a good time out there.
Scott Craven and Jamie Knack, our guests today. I'm Larry Mueller. You can join in with your own questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today, Larry Mueller here with my two guests, Scott Craven and Jamie Knack from UW Extension and the UW-Madison Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Lots of emails, lots of callers online. I think we'll take an email. We haven't done that yet. So Trevor emailed. He's doing a big year this year, and for all birders will know what a big year is. He needs help in identifying a bird. It's the size of a bald eagle, looks like a bald eagle, but no white head or tail. They are brown with gold streaks and markings. He's been told there have been golden eagles around. Does he need a photo to mark it down in eBirds because he believes they are rare for this area?
Well, thank you for the email, Trevor. Bald eagles will not get their typical or have that adult plumage with the white on the head and tail until about 4 years old. So it's quite possible that you have an immature. And certainly if you're seeing other adult bald eagles in the area, I think it's a possibility that you just are looking at an immature bald eagle. However, we do have golden eagles occasionally, as you mentioned, pretty, you know, not super common, but have been sighted in Wisconsin. And I think if you did go into eBird for your area, you could look to see if others have reported any sightings of either bald or golden eagles in your area. And that might be helpful to just see if that's a possibility. You know, just looking at or thinking about pure odds, it's more than likely to be more likely to be an immature bald eagle than a golden eagle. But again, something you could do some exploring with the most recent reports on eBird. And I do not believe that when you report on eBird, you need to submit a photo for rarer species. It is, you are taken, you know, kind of for your word on that. So,
So a big year, there's a great book. It's called The Big Year. I think they even made a movie out of it. And it, you know, start at the beginning of the year and see how many bird species you can find.
Document for the year.
Document for the year. So it's a fun thing to do. And Trevor, I hope you'll keep us up to date on how you're doing.
Yeah, and I would also encourage you to look at folks in your area who are submitting reports through eBird and see if you can't hook up with some of those other birders.
A
lot of fun
idea.
And a great, you know, great network of inviting people to do some of that work with.
John emailed in Forest County and he says Canada jays were common in Forest County, but he hasn't seen any in years.
We could also refer to the eBird data for that question too. It's so the Wisconsin eBird is a place for citizen scientists to document their birding observations. And again, if you went to that website and just did an internet search for Wisconsin eBird, you could actually look at drill down to Canada jays, use that as your species search, and see where they have been documented. Both this year, but in previous years. So you can really explore that data and see if you're seeing any changes. I don't you know, spend a lot of time in the winter here up in northern Wisconsin to be able to comment personally. Scott's got a cabin up in Price County. I don't know that I've heard you talk about Canada Jays.
Well, I mean, not very far from there. I remember Harry Croy over yep. in Fifield, which wasn't very far from my cabin, and he had Canada Jays all around his place regularly. And I remember the Canada Jays are nice. Kind of, there's yeah, some people know bird, them as Whiskey yeah. Jacks. They're kind yeah. of a neat bird. But what I really thought was cool was he had made a feeder that was kind of about an inch and a half square, and what he fed the Canada Jays were frozen margarine sticks. And he'd go to the grocery store when margarine, cheap margarine, was 49 cents a pound, and he'd buy 50 pounds of it and put it in the freezer. And then all he had to do was unwrap a frozen stick and drop it in this little tube, and the gray jays loved it.
Yeah, good fat.
So that was kind of a neat thing, but I haven't seen a gray jay up there personally for many years.
Yeah.
Well, let's take another call. Kathy in Madison has online next. Kathy, hello.
Hi, Larry. This is Kathy, and I'm having a problem with a bat in my attic. When I go to put my Christmas ornaments up there, this squeaking comes out of a suitcase that's hanging on the side of the wall, and I'm wondering what I can do to safely move him. I'm trying peppermint oil. I'm trying ultrasound sound makers. I'm wondering if I could just drop that suitcase into a plastic bag and take it outside, and he would go find some other place to live.
So, Kathy, thank you very much for your call. I appreciate it and understand the, you know, not wanting to have a bat in the attic and be a resident. However, this is probably not the best time of the year to deal with a bat. And the reason is bats will hibernate in the winter. We have about 8 species of bats in the state. About half of those species will migrate to southern parts of the country. Where there are still insects for them to eat and to survive over the winter months. The other 4 species of our bats will actually overwinter in Wisconsin by hibernating. So they don't have access to insects, flying insects, in the winter. And so they basically sleep through the winter. And so at this time of the year, if you do have a bat that has chosen your attic to hibernate in, and it does happen occasionally, it's really not going to have a chance of survival if you were to put it outside, because it's now awakened, it's flying around, and there are no flying insects for it to eat to replenish its energy that it's lost. So your options are to let the bat be until spring, and then it will leave on its own. And then you'll need to find, as we talked about earlier with the flying squirrels, you'll need to find out how it is getting access to the house and exclude it from being able to get back into the attic next time. Or if you are, really wanting to deal with this right now, I'd suggest contacting a wildlife rehabilitator who would be licensed and have the knowledge to be able to overwinter that bat. I think that's probably a secondary option, best option for the bat is to just leave it as it is until spring. But if you're looking for a wildlife rehabilitator to step in and help, if you go to the Department of Natural Resources website and just do a search for wildlife rehabilitator, they have a directory. And you can look at that directory based on your county and then find one that will specialize or will take in bats. And again, call them first and have that conversation. But I think those are your options. As I see them at this time of year.
Thanks, Kathy. Appreciate it. Carrie in Rhinelander will go to you next. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, guys. Great show. Just want to add a couple of little questions here real quick. Do wolves have any reference with deer that people are seeing or not seeing in the woods? Inevitably, that comes up in conversation when we talk about deer numbers, especially over the holidays with family members. And also having a friendly little argument with some folks about whether or not porcupines are detrimental to trees to the extreme in the forest. And I'll take my answers off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling.
He didn't say what side he was on.
Well, the wolf issue and how they affect the deer population is complicated and contentious. And the definitive answer is probably a little elusive, but I hate to keep referring to Outdoor News. You'd think I was getting a kickback from them, but there was an interesting chart in there and an article where some, I think it was a wolf advocacy group, had done some calculating based on DNR data on how many wolves and packs and so forth were in a given county. And they used the number of, for the sake of argument, they used 20 as the number of deer needed to support a wolf over the course of the year. And that's been around, 17 to 20, been around for decades.
Right.
But wolves eat other things other than deer. But nevertheless, for the sake of argument, they did the calculations. Okay, there's 100 wolves in County X, and they each are responsible for the deaths of 20 deer. That's 2,000 dead deer. And the purpose of the article was to compare the deer harvest by humans with the deer harvested by wolves. And the surprising thing, and I think what jumped out at everybody, was there were now counties in the Northwoods where this calculated wolf kill exceeded the human harvest.
Huh.
And that's going to cause just another – it's like throwing kerosene on the argument about what kind of a problem we really have here. There are a number of problems with that rather kind of straightforward review, but nevertheless, it gets you thinking. What it got me thinking about was, well, geez, that's just wolves. What really needs to be considered here, and that was another point in the article, is the entire predator load that deer face in the Northwoods.
Bear.
Bears in particular. Bears are wonderful predators on, or I shouldn't say wonderful, they're effective predators on fawns in particular. So are coyotes. So are bobcats. And there was another data set that came out, I used it for 10 years ago, again through DNR data, that showed that wolves were not as important in the overall predator kill as some of these other animals. And collectively, what they're showing in that table probably does mean that the predator harvest of deer exceeds what people are taking. Now, is that wrong or bad? That's another matter. But it does suggest that, as you said, Larry, you know, your guys are out there in the area where you've hunted for decades. They saw zero deer. How many wolves did they see? Half a dozen? Four or five? And wolves aren't easy to see in the woods. So all of a sudden, when a group of hunters on a traditionally hunted piece of ground are seeing more wolves than deer, that's a bit of an issue. And even I think what most hunters have concluded is that even if the deer are not necessarily killed, they certainly learn that, hey, we're not going to hang around here where this pack of wolves is hanging out. So they may leave a given area, explaining why a group like yours doesn't see any animals,
yeah,
along with all the other things I talked about previously. So, yeah, I guess the short answer for our caller from Rhinelander is that, sure, there is some impact. I mean, the fact is these are a big predator, and deer are a prey animal, like it or not. And we have to learn to get along with them. But at what point people are going to be happy if the feds finally get – well,
yeah,
that's another matter. But in my opinion, wolves should be delisted and let the state manage them, and that might help. But that isn't in the immediate offing. What was the other question? It was about a –
Oh.
No, it wasn't a
– porcupines.
Porcupines,
yeah.
Well, if the question – I guess the question was, do they have an impact on forests in terms of regeneration or tree health and whatnot? They certainly do gnaw on trees, but I've not seen or heard anything recently where they were considered a major factor.
Yeah,
in,
I think, you know, you might have a local – you know, on your local property, you have an issue with them and be able to control them a bit to deal with it, but I don't think
In the grand scheme,
in the grand
of things,
scheme, on a larger scale, that they have an issue.
In the Shawangan National Forest,
right,
they're not
right.
going to have
plenty
a,
to
a
eat.
Big issue.
If it's in your backyard and you're trying
yes.
to grow the national tree or the tree for right. Rockefeller Center and the porcupine's sitting there, then the good news is they're not very fleet of foot. You can probably do something about it.
So there we go. Tom shared an image of what he thinks is a wolf print. We were talking about wolves here in the snow in the Washburn area. And it shows the hand right next to the print, and it's a pretty big print.
It's a pretty big print. You know, it's always nice to be in person to take a look at these, take some measurements. I can't say for sure one way or the other. It's certainly either a wolf or a large dog. It's too large to be a coyote or a fox. And certainly it is a canid. So.
And Kathy emailed that a varied thrush was sighted the day after Christmas bird count on December 15th in Fifield in northern Wisconsin. She also saw the varied thrush eating crab apples in her tree on November 30th, a beautiful bird, but a native of California. What are its chances of survival or return to its habitat? But there are varied, you see a varied thrush.
Yeah, I think they're, you know, we certainly have them. And again, not surprising to see that they're, focusing on crab apples and some of that last winter fruit that's available this winter. So I don't think that'd be all that uncommon. Think its chances for survival are probably pretty good. It'll move as it needs to if the winter gets more severe.
Scott Craven and Jamie Knack will be with us right up until 12:30 today. Scott, an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. Jamie, a UW Extension senior wildlife outreach specialist. They both reside in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. We'll take a look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. Then we'll be back with our guests. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. My guests, Scott Craven and Jamie Knack from University of Wisconsin Extension and the UW Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Great to have them with us. Questions for them or maybe experiences to share, give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll go back to the phones. A few callers online here. There's still some lines open. Star in Arkdale is up next. Star, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for a great show. I have basically two questions. I throw a lot of variety of bird seed on the ground, which attracts a ton of different types of birds. I'm just wondering if there's a possibility of overfeeding them and then wasting my seeds, or how much do I feed the ground feeding?
Well, that's an excellent question, and I guess I would encourage you to think about, for a couple of reasons, but to think about using elevated feeders as well. There are some of our feeder birds that are ground, you know, feed on the ground, mourning doves, some of the sparrows and so on, juncos. So feeding them their preferred seed on the ground, but while feeding other types of birds, your cardinals, your blue jays, your woodpeckers, feeding them from an elevated feeder, whether that be shelled peanuts, black oil sunflower, those are the two that are going to get you the most bang for your buck in terms of diversity of species, being more of a preferred seed, and then not having a lot of waste. So you want to avoid commercial mixes that have a lot of fillers in them and spend the extra money on a higher quality seed. My concern with feeding too much on the ground is that we often have callers who have issues with mammals, small mammals or larger mammals, whether that be ground squirrels in the warmer months, chipmunks, but also raccoons and possum and skunk can come in to forage on that extra feed that's left over. So, you know, I think there's some concerns with just having it all laying on the ground like that. In addition, if you're in a county where there's a ban on baiting and feeding because of chronic wasting disease, you also are required to have that food out of reach of deer. So that would just be something to be mindful of, too. If you're feeding cracked corn or things that might bring deer in, you actually need to elevate it to make it out of reach. So feeding some of the ground birds, great. And then I think maybe picking some of the other style feeders and specifically targeting some of the other species like the suet, you know, the woodpeckers with the suet and shelled peanuts and the black oil sunflower seeds would be great.
And Star, you had another question about woodpeckers, if I'm not mistaken.
Thank you for that advice, but it brings up the suet question. I have a suet feeder and the pileated woodpecker's coming to it, but he's also pecking at the tree right next to it. And There's no bugs now, so what is he doing?
Well, there could be bugs in the form of larvae in that tree. So chances are when you start to see woodpeckers on a tree or sapsuckers, you know, causing that damage, that tree is probably already on its way out. In other words, it's in some state of decay, and the woodpeckers are locating food in it. So we have folks, you know, who are obviously concerned about saving their tree or protecting their tree. You can try to wrap it with metal flashing or something,
hardware cloth,
you know, to prevent access. But in the long run, I think more often we see that that's a tree that's already dying or diseased as well. So woodpeckers can be an issue on cedar siding. We see reports, you know, oh, should we put out a bunch of suet feeders and try to attract them over there? I just haven't seen any scientific evidence that, you know, suet feeders help prevent woodpeckers from, you know, getting at trees or the sides of the houses or...
Yeah.
You know, really, really help. So
there you go, Star. Thank you very much for calling. Madeline in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Madeline.
Hi. I think there are way too many deer. I think you should ask the insurance company that pay for damage to cars. I know of two women who recently, well, one was my daughter, and she was... thank God she was only going about 45 miles an hour when this, you know, it's at night when you don't see them. They're just bound right in front of you. And as far as these hunters that are complaining, they don't want to get out and hunt like people used to hunt. They just want to, you know, and I can't believe these people that want to go and hunt caged deer, these rich people. They make me sick because that's where all this chronic wasting disease is coming from. And I can't help but believe that they're feeding them that ground-up food, and that's where all that started.
Well, Madeline, thanks for calling. Scott, you may have some comments.
Well, I mean, Madeline raises some valid points. Highway mortality, deer vehicle collisions have been an issue since we had cars first on the road, and we're talking in the state tens of thousands of collisions, in the country way more than that, and it's costly. It costs human life and injury. It kills a lot of deer, and it's a problem. But it's been a problem for a long time, and most of the steps from fencing to signage and flashing lights and motion detectors and assorted other things have maybe helped, but have not been completely successful. So bottom line is, this is one of the hazards on our state's highways that anybody driving has to be aware of and be a little cautious, especially at sunrise, sunset, times when deer are active, or if you're near an area where you know deer are moving from a woodlot to a cornfield or whatever, you have to be careful. The deer, at least around my house, I live right on the edge of the metro deer zone, and the road is the boundary, and I watch the deer leave my prairie and go up to the road, and they stop and look both ways, and if there's somebody coming, they go back in the prairie grass, and if there's not, they proceed across the road. So maybe the deer are going to solve the problem before we're able to.
Maybe. Oh, my goodness. Well, she also mentioned deer farms.
Well,
she's not happy with deer farms.
There was just a report apparently on the news while we were shut down over noon that the number of CWD cases that had turned up on deer farms, it used to be, I guess it still is, but it used to be a bigger business in Wisconsin. The numbers of deer farms have been dwindling because of the problems posed by CWD, and I have a feeling that trend is probably going to continue. As far as this issue of canned hunts and people hunting on shooting preserves where the deer are in fenced enclosures, that's another whole matter. It certainly isn't anything that interests me or virtually anybody I've ever hunted with. But for some people, it seems to be attractive. I don't know why, but
there it is.
It's a market-driven thing.
Tim and Marinette, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hi. I have a story. Actually, there's two parts to it, but it's very, very fascinating. I was downhill skiing many years ago with a guy that was a hunter, and there was a pen down on the slope, and it had a 10-point buck and two doe. And Mark goes like this. He goes, meh. And I said, what's that? He said, what's a deer? So I go, meh. And he goes, oh, you do that good. Do it again. So I did it again. And that buck looked up at us, and he turned his head all the way around where he was facing backwards, and he snapped his neck, and he sheared that rack right off, and it fell in the snow. And we were just amazed. Mark thought they just fell off. So then a few years later, I'm at a Packer game tailgating, and I see Neil, who runs the zoo in Green Bay. And I go over to him, and I say, you know, when I go to a zoo, sometimes I'll see a buck, and he'll have a rack. When he doesn't normally have a rack. And he says, well, you know how we do that? And I said, what do you mean, you do that? He says, yeah. He says, when that buck has that rack, he says, we'll castrate him. He'll never lose it now. He's now a show buck. Have your guests ever heard of that?
Well, it's interesting that you, I don't know what to say on the first one, whether that was just you were in the right place at the right time when he dropped, shed the rack or what. But my deer hunting season this year, I was hunting with my daughter who shot a buck on opening morning, and it had velvet. So it was a 2.5-year-old buck, about a 7-pointer. And it was in full velvet. And so being a geek on all this stuff was looking up what, you know, what causes that. And so it's cryptor or orchidism. And what would have happened is either a birth defect or an injury, perhaps jumping a fence or something like that, an injury to the testicles, that it no longer produces enough testosterone to go through the rutting. So it would have no scraping, rutting behavior. And would never shed those antlers. So eventually you could get what you may see online sometimes called a cactus buck, where you've got velvet and it just continues to get a more massive at the pedestal and continues to grow that velvet on top year after year, but they never shed their antlers again. So I think that coincides with your second story there about an injury to the testicles and then not producing the testosterone that's required to go through that behavior and shed the antlers.
Oh, interesting. Tim, thanks. Appreciate your call. That's something I don't think we ever talked about on the show.
No, when we were talking to a bunch of taxidermists and other deer biologists and so on, and it's pretty unusual.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
There we go. Thanks, Tim. Appreciate it. Let's go to Joe in Viroqua next. Hi, Joe.
Good afternoon. I got two subjects, deer and birds. To begin with the deer, I second the motion on that lady that mentioned there's too many deer around. And probably the problem is associated with they hang out where people don't hunt. I believe that's probably got part of the problem. And now birds. I've seen the big ear twice. And I highly recommend it. And another thing, now in the last couple of years, I've noticed goldfinches preferring to eat sunflower seeds that still have their hulls on and not caring for the thistle seed. I'm concerned that the thistle seed maybe is stale. Is stale bird seed much of a problem?
Scott, what about it?
Well, I mean, first, it's intuitive that deer gravitate to areas where they're not pressured by hunters, so that in closed parks or land that's posted, the deer tend to gravitate to those areas pretty quickly once the shooting starts. As far as the bird seed's concerned, I guess I've never really heard of stale seed as being much of an issue. Moldy seed occasionally, or if it gets wet, that's something you want to dispose of. But at least in my case, I store it either in the commercial bags or in cans, and I think some of it probably gets to the point where it's a year or two old. But if it's dry enough and the seed is still present within the husk, you know, I still put it out and the birds seem to utilize it.
Yeah, the only time I've run into it is with the thistle seed, and that is through the thistle feeder when it gets wet and moldy. And if they're not visiting, it's just time to dump that seed, throw it away, clean out your feeders with a little weak bleach solution, let them dry, and then refill them, and it doesn't seem to be a problem.
No, there we go. Joe, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. We've got several emails I want to get to. We were talking about managing land earlier in the show, and Tim Isley, who appears on this show from time to time with our outdoor writers, emailed to point out that anyone interested in managing land, there's a conference coming up in Oshkosh on January 25th. It's put on by the Wild Ones, and you can find out more information at toward harmonywithnature.org. That's toward harmonywithnature.org. And then Matt emailed that there's this, someone had wondered about a bat they had in their house, and Matt emailed that there's a service out of Madison, and I think our caller was from Madison, a service out of Madison that will collect your bat and put it outside in spring. They picked his up in Wausau, so they went all the way to Wausau.
Yeah, and again, I think going through that wildlife rehabilitator directory with on the DNR website will help you get to those folks. I can't keep track of who's in what location across the state. But yeah, great. Thank you.
Yeah, Bat Conservation of Wisconsin may be a spot for that. Mary is having problems with mice getting in her car, chewing the wiring in the motor area, and probably other areas as well. Do you have any deterrents? She doesn't want to kill them.
Not wanting to kill them is tough. And it doesn't say whether she has a garage or if this car is being parked outside. But if it is in a garage, I would encourage her to run a trap line to keep those numbers down, as we heard from other callers and certainly hear from folks that we interact with, too. I mean, these animals can cause a lot of damage.
I have a car guy, an auto repair guy, on my show, and there are some sprays again.
Sprays. I've heard Bounce fabric softener folks have used. You have to be probably a little bit careful about where you leave that sit.
But there's a capsaicin spray that mice do not like.
Yep.
Moth flakes have been a long-time solution, too, just putting a handful in a mesh bag, a piece of nylon stocking or an onion bag or whatever, and then somehow attaching that off to the side of the engine housing so it's not interfering with anything mechanical, especially if the car is stored for a period of time, and that may help. Ammonia also is a bit of a mammal repellent. But the real issue, as Jamie points out, is get rid of the mice.
Yeah.
Well, Mitch called. He's got a good solution for hunting. He called to tell you, Scott, that he need that you need to look up statistics where there are more car deer accidents. That's the place to hunt. It worked for him.
That's just look for the signs. This looks like a good spot.
I do remember a guy saying that. He hunted near an area where there was a road sign that said deer crossing, caution,
right.
And actually got a deer.
Right.
Got deer. Oh, man. John emailed that they are periodic visitors to their second home in the Driftless area. When there, they set out feeders and a bird bath. Any harm to this scheme of intermittent feeding by attracting birds to our area and then suddenly withdrawing the food source?
I'm a little torn with that because when you look at some of the bird feeding resources and websites, you know, it usually starts with, you know, think about how much time and how much money you want to spend on it. And if you're going to start feeding birds, to be prepared to see it all the way through. And especially as you get into late winter and spring where resources are even more depleted. That being said, I think some of it depends on the area. If you're in a more suburban, rural area where you have other people feeding birds and they have other sources of food to go to, it may not be a big issue. But if you're really, you know, those birds are becoming dependent on that food source, it can be, you know, detrimental to start and then stop abruptly, especially during a major snowstorm or cold spell. So, you know, you might think about whether you could buy larger capacity feeders and more feeders, or see about having a neighbor fill the feeders for you, or perhaps just don't do it.
No, don't. It's good. All good suggestions.
Just add a couple of things. People are obviously concerned about the well-being of the birds that are coming to their feeders. They've been worried about overfeeding them, using stale seed, or intermittent feeding. But I think we're begging the question of what the real mortality problems are around feeders, and one is window collisions.
Yep.
I'm amassing quite a supply of excellent bird specimens for our museum collection in my freezer, simply by birds that are hitting our large windows. I've tried everything I can think of to deal with the reflection, but it's not easy, especially on modern houses that have a lot of glass. So that's a big problem. We talked a little bit about feed, especially with all the rain we've had, the feed getting caked up and even sprouting if it's warm enough and getting moldy and everything else. The feeders need to be cleaned. That's a risk. And the third one, which it's late in the program, so I don't mind stirring the pot a little bit, is keep your darn cats in the house. And with that, I'm through.
Well, I'll add two tips then related to those things. So with the window collisions, there's been a lot of research. So if you can place your bird feeders within 3 feet of the window or greater than 30 feet from the window, you can help reduce window collision strike or mortality or injuries from the strike. So within 3 feet, they can't build up enough momentum or typically don't build up enough momentum to hurt themselves. And if it's greater than 30 feet, if you have a sharp-shinned hawk or a cat, something come by that startles them, they have enough distance to be able to react and avoid that window. And then in addition with thinking about these ambush predators or cats that may be lurking around, it's a good idea to have cover nearby for your bird feeders. But you really want that cover to be about 10 to 12 feet away from the feeders themselves so that the animals can't hide very close to the feeders.
Right.
So cover nearby, but not right up to the feeder.
We mentioned just in passing Eagle Watch, and you know we'll be talking about Eagle Days next Thursday at 11:45, but there are some good places, there will be some good places to go see bald eagles.
Yeah, so January, February is the, you know, the highlight of the year for being able to go and observe bald eagles. There's the Sauk Prairie's Bald Eagle Watching Days, January 17th to the 18th in Sauk Prairie, and basically celebrating the recovery of bald eagles in the state and being able to attend programs, educational events, being able to observe them. Your car is the best location to observe them. You'll be nice and warm, but you don't disturb them either. And there's spotting scopes available, and typically they release a few rehabilitated bald eagles during those events.
We were talking about predators earlier to deer, and a listener sent me a video of a bald eagle actually drowning a fawn deer that happened to be in the water.
Yeah, on a lake. I think I saw that.
And then actually fed on it for quite a few days, so they can even be predators.
Yes.
Oh
yes.
My goodness me! Well, this has been great, interesting to me. Don't forget, we'll have a list up on our site. Larry Mueller, go to the Larry Mueller Show for all of the problems with the animals in Australia, places where you can help out. And Scott will be back on February 5th, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe not. We'll find out. I think he will. Or maybe Jamie will be back. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening. Jamie Nack and Scott Craven. Always a pleasure to have them with us here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.